Good morning, everybody. This is Jenna Mooney from Davis Wright Tremaine. I'm so excited to be moderating this webinar today, Transgender Issues in the Workplace, Navigating a Rapidly Changing Landscape. I have with me Paul Southwick and Sarah Ames, both of whom are experts on this topic, and just think this is a really timely and important topic to talk about. Both of them are incredibly passionate about it and well-versed, so we're really fortunate to be able to hear from them today. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to Sarah Ames.
All right. Thank you, Jenna. And thank you, everyone, for joining us on this call. We learned this morning that we are breaking records with attendance for this webinar, and I think that is just a testament to how important this issue is. This is really front of mind for a lot of our clients, which is why we are hosting this today. Jenna and I and our entire employment group have noticed a real uptick in both questions from employers and also issues in litigation regarding gender identity. And we decided that we would bring Paul in today to talk with all of you because he is really our firm's resource on gender identity law. Paul is not an employment attorney, but he focuses on gender identity in all aspects of litigation. And so he brings a unique perspective and understanding to employers' questions surrounding gender identity in the workplace. Today we will give you a brief overview of the state of the law. I know it is very confusing. It is hard to keep up with all of the changes. So we'll give you a little primer in where things stand now. Then we will get into some terminology that you're likely to hear when you're dealing with gender identity in the workplace. And finally, the bulk of this webinar is really devoted, will be devoted to common issues that we see. We have collectively gone through the issues that we have seen rise from our own or from our clients, and we've compiled those into some common questions that we see over and over. But this is about you, and this is about your questions. So to the extent you came here today with a question in mind, please do not hesitate to go ahead and ask that question. If you look at your screen, you'll see on the lower left-hand side there's a chat box for you to type in your questions. Go ahead and send those to us. Nobody else on the call will see the question except for us. Jenna is going to be going through all of those questions and pulling out the ones that seem most indicative of questions that everyone is asking and that we hear over and over again. So please ask your questions now. If something sparks your attention as we're talking, ask a question then. It won't distract us, we promise. We just want to be able to get to all of your concerns. That brings us to our presentation today. And why are we here? We are here because of the increased national attention on transgender individuals. As you can see, transgender issues are appearing more and more frequently in the media. We have a slide here to illustrate that with the lovely Caitlyn Jenner and Laverne Cox, two transgender women who have gained national prominence recently. And also, as anyone who's watching the news recently has seen, the states are delving into this issue and enacting or attempting to enact laws regarding rights for rights related to gender identity. All of this results in a very confusing situation for our clients. Now, we understand that really your interest is just complying with the law. You want to make sure you don't tread on any toes here. And so we are here to help you figure out how to do that today. We need to start at the top when figuring out what an employer's obligation is, and that is at the federal level. States may enact specific regulations on gender identity. However, ultimately, federal law trumps. Now, there is a federal law on dealing with employment discrimination on the workplace. We're all familiar with it. It's Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits employment discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, and that's in purple on your slide for a reason, and national origin. Now, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, not only did it create these protections for employees, it also created the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC. The EEOC is tasked with interpreting and enforcing this act. So in other words, the EEOC decides what really is meant by race, color, religion, sex, and national origin. And the EEOC came out in 2012, and it said, and it's on its website, that Title VII, prohibition on sex discrimination, specifically covers lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals. That means that according to the federal government, gender identity is included in sex discrimination, and that applies to all 50 states, regardless of where you are. And I know that comes as a surprise to some of you because there is such a focus on the state level for different laws and regulations. Now, what this means is that while there may not be a state prohibition and you may not face state charges for gender discrimination based on gender identity, you do run the risk of a federal lawsuit, because the EEOC does more than just interpret the law, and it does more than just deal with one-off charges from employees. The EEOC also has the power to bring charges itself. The EEOC works with the Department of Justice, the DOJ, to bring charges on issues that it feels are really at the forefront of the law and that need to be addressed on a federal level. So with that, I'm going to turn it to Paul to delve a little more. Well, I should actually probably say that because the EEOC has decided and is enforcing sex discrimination on behalf of gender identity, that means that we are here today to focus on gender identity laws, because they are going to apply to everyone in the country. Now, Paul, with that, do you want to get into what gender identity means and terms people are likely to hear?
Great. Thank you, Sarah. Yeah, so as we delve into these issues, it's important that we're all on the same page with the terminology. Now, some of the terms that we're going to go over, you will have heard before. Some will be different, or maybe you've heard them, but you're not sure exactly what they mean. So we'll start out with the very basics. Now, these are terms that are defined by the American Psychological Association, which pretty much sets the standard for terminology, and these are the terms that are going to be used by the EEOC and by courts in any litigation that would arise relating to a transgender employee. So the first term first, sex. Sex is a term that refers to what a person is assigned at birth, male or female. It refers to a biological status rather than any kind of social construct. And it's primarily associated with physical attributes such as chromosomes, hormones, and anatomy. Now, in contrast to sex, gender is a socially constructed identifier, and it refers to roles, behaviors, activities, those kinds of things that our society considers appropriate for boys and men or girls and women. And gender roles and gender constructs can change from culture to culture, even from region to region throughout the United States, while biological sex is something that we see as a consistent throughout society. So those are the two main terms that everyone is probably familiar with. And when we refer to those terms, we're usually thinking in terms of a gender binary. And what a gender binary is it's basically classifying sex and gender into two opposite and disconnected forms that traditionally have been viewed as unchanging. So where does that bring us to now and with today's topic? So for transgender individuals, the sex and gender binary really crumbles, and we have to familiarize ourselves with additional terminology. So the next two terms that we have on the current slide are gender identity and gender expression. Most federal and state statutes that will prohibit gender identity discrimination also include gender expression discrimination. Now, gender identity refers to a person's internal sense of being male, female, or something else. So it's how that they internally identify themselves. Gender expression refers to the way they communicate that gender identity to the outside world. So by clothing, by hairstyles, by mannerisms, those sorts of things. So for a transgender person, they may have identified as female, had a gender identity as female, but their gender expression may not yet be female for a number of reasons. They may not feel comfortable at work. They may not be far along in their process of expressing themselves as female, but eventually they will at work. Now, the term transgender, that is an umbrella term. It incorporates it refers to a person whose gender identity, expression, or behavior does not conform to that we typically associate with the sex they were assigned at birth. And it can include someone who has undergone surgery. It can include someone who is taking hormones, Or it can include someone who has done neither of those things. A person can be transgender and not have undergone any kind of medical intervention or even have undergone any changing of legal documents. So it's important to remember that that term is a very broad term that encompasses people at all stages. Now, the last term I have on the screen is probably something you haven't heard of. A lot of people haven't, and it's the term cisgender. And that term refers to a person whose gender identity and gender expression align with the sex they were assigned at birth. So for the vast majority of the population, the vast majority is cisgender. They have an identity and an expression that aligns with what they were assigned at birth. And for transgender folks, that is not the case. So that's a bit on the terminology. If you have any questions on terminology, you can go ahead and submit those if you like. But those are the terms that we're going to be operating with. So then we need to get into the law. And as Sarah said, federal law is where we start because that really applies across the board regardless of what state you're operating in. And the EEOC in 2012 made a very important ruling in the case of Macy versus Department of Justice. That's Mia Macy right there. She was a transgender employee. A potential employee. She applied for a job with a federal job. And after being offered the job, she expressed her desire to transition at the work, that she was going to now be a woman in the federal workplace, and then the government refused to hire her. And so this was a refusal to hire case, and for the first time, the EEOC said not only is discriminating against a transgender person cognizable as sex stereotyping discrimination, but they said that gender identity discrimination is per se sex discrimination. And so that is really the rule across the board. That's what the EEOC is going to be operating under when they review complaints or when they decide to intervene in a case. Now, I have a little note on this slide, EEOC lawsuits in 2014 in Michigan and Florida. And I want to mention that because those are the first two cases that the Department of Justice has brought against private employers relating to gender identity discrimination. And they were brought on the same day in a real effort by the EEOC to show that they are taking this seriously and that they consider gender identity discrimination to be sex discrimination.
And Paul, I'd just like to jump in and highlight for our listeners that these lawsuits were brought in states that do not have state protections for gender identity. So we really do think the EEOC is making a point here that the federal protections for gender identity trump and that they apply to all 50 states regardless of any state protections.
That's right, Sarah. And I'll just quickly note that they can come with a high price tag. The lawsuit in Florida was settled for $150,000 and required training, and that was a single plaintiff lawsuit. The case in Michigan is ongoing, but a motion to dismiss by the employer was denied. So these cases, if not handled properly, can be expensive. So in addition to the federal ruling under the EEOC, there are state laws that prohibit employment discrimination based on gender identity. Now, on this map, this is updated to the current date, so things can change as state legislatures make decisions. But as of today, we have 20 states and the District of Columbia that prohibit employment discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. So those are the dark purple states that you see there. A lot of them on the West Coast and the East Coast, but we got some Midwest and Hawaii there as well. Then there are two states in fuchsia, and they prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation only. And I mention it in this webinar because what we often see is a state will first prohibit sexual orientation discrimination, and then down the road it will include gender identity discrimination. So I expect to see those two states to flip to the dark purple in the near future. Then we've got some other colors, the lighter purple colors. There are other states which prohibit discrimination against public employees based on gender identity or sexual orientation. And I know a lot of people participating in this webinar work for public employers. So in those states, there are six that include gender identity and 10 that include sexual orientation. And you can see that on the map there. So the purpose of this is to illustrate that there is a federal rule. There are also state regulations. And these state regulations will be interpreted by state agencies. And so as you see complaints filed by employees with your respective state agencies, expect them to refer to these state statutes as well. And the regulations under these state statutes can be somewhat different. So it's important to become familiar or seek advice when handling a state-based complaint. And I just want to briefly mention that there are some local laws, particularly in Seattle, Multnomah County, which includes Portland, New York City, D.C. Other local jurisdictions are making even stricter rules with respect to gender identity, restroom use, and similar issues. So even within your locality, it's important to know the rules on these issues. And with that, I'll turn it over to Sarah to walk us through some of the kinds of claims that you're familiar seeing in the traditional sex discrimination context and what they might look like in a gender identity context.
All right. Thank you, Paul. I do quickly want to highlight one more point on this map, though, for everybody listening. Keep in mind that the EEOC is an agency, it's an administrative agency. So with a change in administration, as we may see, as we will see in November, we're not sure what the new priorities of that administration will be. That could change enforcement priorities of the EEOC. However, if you are in one of these 20 states that already has a state protection for gender identity, it doesn't matter what the federal government does unless they enact a law specifically allowing gender identity discrimination, although we don't see that as likely. But so employers in these 20 states need to pay extra attention and know that regardless of what happens in November, gender identity is still a protected class in their state. All right. Now, as Paul mentioned, we want to walk through a few typical claims that we see regarding sex discrimination. And Paul, I will go over briefly what the claim is, and then Paul is going to walk us through what that will look like with a transgender employee. So a hostile work environment claim. These claims are threatened all the time. They are frequently brought. Your typical sex harassment claim is written, unless it's quid pro quo, it's usually a hostile work environment claim. For harassment to be actionable, it has to be unwelcome. That's fairly self-explanatory. It has to be subjectively and objectively offensive, and it has to be severe and pervasive. And those last two bullet points are where we generally build our defenses around the offensiveness and the severity and pervasiveness. So what would a traditional hostile work environment claim look like? I can think of one recently where we had Muslim employees who were working with, they were recent immigrants from the Middle East. This was a post 9/11 world, and they were subject to really daily harassment from some of their supervisors, and that's key, it's their supervisors, about ISIS, for example, about, 9/11, and they were asked if they were terrorists, et cetera. They were told to go back to Iraq, all of that. That's the makings, really, of a hostile work environment claim. So, Paul, with a transgender employee, what would you expect to see?
For a transgender employee, a hostile work environment claim, I'd expect to see one or more of the following factors. It could include other coworkers misgendering the employee, so that means using the incorrect pronoun. So if it's a transgender woman who has transitioned from male to female, and coworkers still refer to this woman as he and him, misgendering is a basis for a hostile work environment claim. If a transgender male is not allowed to use the men's restroom and is forced to use the women's restroom, that could be part of a hostile work environment claim. And I will just note that the EEOC this year brought another lawsuit, and that was based on the failure to allow the transgender employee to access the restroom that aligned with their gender identity and involved employees using incorrect pronouns for the employee. And that case was settled very quickly for $115,000 with the EEOC. So that's the kind of hostile work environment claim that I would expect to see.
Thank you. And I think an important piece to underline there is the second prong of this, subjectively and objectively offensive. This is something that Paul is highlighting. What is offensive to the average person on this call, to a non-transgender individual, is not necessarily the same as what is offensive to somebody who is, especially someone who is actively transitioning. I think that we are going to see increased testimony, increased mental health worker testimony on this second prong to support an understanding of the subjective effect it has on an employee. And so you really need to listen to your transgender employees, and if they are telling you that their coworker's conduct is causing them distress, take that seriously. Even if it doesn't seem objectively offensive to you, it's important to try to understand and their concerns to combat a hostile work environment claim. Now, I just want to add a little footnote to this part of the presentation. We're walking you through some risk areas. I want to make it very clear that Jenna and I defend these claims regularly, and we set the bar very high for you when we give you advice. We want to make sure you don't even approach the threshold of a hostile work environment. So don't throw up your hands in dismay if you find yourself in this situation. We can certainly build a defense. We just don't want you to even get there. All right. Now let's look at a gender discrimination claim. We see these claims quite frequently. Gender discrimination requires someone be a member of a protected class, in this case gender, that they are subject to an adverse employment action, and that the adverse employment action occurred because of their protected class. And that is the most important part of this test. Really, you have to show that what happened to you at work happened because you are traditionally a woman. So, for example, perhaps you apply for you have a female employee who applies for a promotion. She is told, you know, wouldn't you rather stay at home with your kids? They could really use a mom there when they get home from school. We're not sure if this promotion is right for you right now. Well, that would be pretty clear gender discrimination. Paul, what would you expect that to look like for transgender employees?
For a transgender employee, a claim may look like the following scenario. An employee comes up to HR and says, I'd like to transition at work. I'd like to do it in the next month. And then the employer says, well, maybe you need to take some additional time off while you are making this transition, and essentially forces or coerces the employee into taking time away from work or leaving the workplace entirely while they undergo the transition. That kind of a scenario would likely give rise to this kind of a gender discrimination claim. And unfortunately, we've seen that happen. But you have to be careful here, because the employee, particularly if they are undergoing medical treatment, the employee may want to take some time off to recover from either surgery or the beginning of hormones. So you do need to have sensitive and careful conversations with the employee and allow enough time off if the employee requests it, but you cannot force an employee to take time off merely because they are undergoing a gender transition.
Right, and I always think of this as similar to pregnancy leave or maternity leave. Just because you have a policy that allows for your employees to have, say, 4 months off after they have a child, it doesn't mean that you force your employees to take 4 months off after they have a child. It's the same with a gender transition, as Paul is discussing. Now, failure to hire claims are essentially looked at through the same lens as basic gender discrimination, but we broke them out here because they have special applicability to transgender employees. As Paul mentioned, the hallmark case, Macy, is a failure to hire claim. So for a failure to hire claim, an employee is, again, a member of a protected class, in this case, gender or a gender identity, a transgender individual. They were not hired for a position because of their protected class. Now, typically you might see this with your standard gender discrimination claim. You have somebody interviewing who is visibly pregnant. They meet all the requirements, but you're just not sure if you want to bring someone on who's about to have a baby, who may be distracted, who may quit. So the pregnant applicant doesn't get the job because of their pregnancy. In transgender cases, and Jenna and I have actually dealt with this already, we've dealt with these claims where you have someone who applies for the job presenting as one gender, and then when the job, when the reference check goes through, you see a different gender listed on the driver's license or on some paperwork, and that raises some concerns, and often these concerns are expressed as, well, this applicant wasn't truthful during the application process. Paul, what do you think about that response from employers? Well, we're not discriminating based on the fact that they're transgender. We're saying, hey, wait a second, we said what's your gender and you lied.
Yes, Sarah, we've seen circumstances where an employer has used the defense of gender fraud. based on a mismatch between the expressed gender of the employee and the legal documents. While that may have been a valid defense in the past, in the 90s and early 2000s, you may find some judges that were willing to find that as a valid defense, it's unlikely to be considered a valid defense in any court or with any agency now. So the best practice in that case to avoid liability would not refuse to hire or terminate an employee for that reason.
Right. And another way we've seen failure to hire arise in the gender identity context is you have an employee or you have an applicant who you have made a provisional offer to, and then it's time for them to receive their uniform assignment. And they say, no, I don't want to receive the male uniform. I want to receive the female uniform because I am a transgendered woman. And this is an instance where it's really important to educate your frontline supervisors, because often if this had been escalated to HR, your HR employees would know how to deal with this situation. But for a frontline supervisor, they're not used to seeing it. They do not think of gender identity as a protected class. And it's really more of a check-the-box mentality where they say, wait, you're refusing to wear the uniform that you're required to wear. I'm sorry, you can no longer work here. And that is a claim that I have seen brought by transgender employees, failure to hire claim that has been brought. All right, so I think that covers our basic claims. Now, Paul has a quick survey that he has designed for you all. Do a little data mining here while you're on the phone, and then we're going to get into some common issues and common questions that we see.
All right. Thank you, Sarah. Yeah, so on your screen, you should see a survey that has popped up. And this isn't going to show your name or company next to it, so you can go ahead and answer. But it is the question that I'm proposing to the group is, have you ever hired a transgender employee or had a transgender employee transition? And the reason I'm asking this is to kind of get a sense from the audience of how many folks have already dealt with this, or how many are seeing these issues for the very first time, or haven't seen them yet, but expect to see them in the near future. So I'm just going to give you, maybe 30 seconds to go ahead, read that question, and write your answer. I think at the end, I will share the overall results, which show the number of yeses to the number of noes. And that way, folks can see that. And then we'll, after this survey is done, we'll go ahead and go into some of the very common questions that Sarah, Jenna, and I have seen, and we'll answer some of your questions that have been coming in. I've been taking notes on those. All right, so I'm going to stop the survey, and I'll share the results. So it looks like 105 people answered yes, and 83 people answered no. So a majority of the people that are participating in this webinar, or at least who answered the survey, have already had the experience of hiring someone who is transgender or having a transgender employee transition at the workplace. But still, a pretty good number of folks have not. So this is going to be new territory. And I will say pretty confidently that if you haven't yet, you likely will in the near future, because with increased visibility means not only that there's increased attention on employers, but that more employees are feeling empowered to transition and they are ready, even if they've always had this gender identity, they're finally ready to start expressing it at work. So you likely will see it in the future. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and Sarah and I are going to go through some of these questions.
Thank you, Paul. All right. This should come as no surprise to anyone. Restroom use and sex segregated facilities. This is our number one question. We get asked about bathroom use all the time. So, Paul, which bathroom should a transgender employee be given access to?
So the general rule is that a transgender employee should be given access to the restroom that aligns with their gender identity. So if they are biologically male or had a male birth certificate but are now living at the workplace as female or expressing themselves as female, they should be given access to the women's restroom. In addition, the same thing for a female-to-male employee should be given access to the men's restroom. It should not be limited based on biological status or the birth certificate of the employee.
What about larger employees or employers with larger facilities who have maybe a men's restroom, a women's restroom, and then also a single-use, often it's a handicapped restroom? Is that sufficient to meet that obligation?
So offering a transgender employee a single-use restroom can be a really great thing, particularly for the employee who's at the initial stages of transitioning or hasn't transitioned yet but still may feel uncomfortable in any gendered kind of restroom. So it's a great option to offer for transgender employees. However, you cannot limit a transgender employee to only using the single-user restroom. You still need to allow them to use the restroom for the gender that they identify with. Now, I also should mention that in some cities, like the city of Seattle, recently passed an ordinance that if you are a place of accommodation, which many of you will be considered places of public accommodation, restaurants, hotels, if you have a single-use restroom, you are no longer allowed to define it as a male single-use or a female single-use. You actually now need to create gender-neutral signage for those kinds of restrooms. So that's why it's particularly important to look at these local rules as well.
That's very interesting. Well, our next question here I think is a very interesting one, and that's the gender-neutral restroom. You know, we are starting to see those more frequently with employers. Is that a way to address the problem?
Yeah, so gender-neutral restrooms, I'll just define it for folks who don't know. It's basically an all-gender restroom, and it could be a single-use or it could be a multi-use restroom. Now, we're seeing a lot of universities, hospital systems, airports, large institutions like that are now creating gender-neutral restrooms, particularly in new construction or when doing remodels of existing buildings. And so if you are a large employer or you're an institution like one that I just mentioned, you may want to consider incorporating gender-neutral restrooms into your plan. And often they are a restroom that is in addition to sex-segregated restrooms. Now, I did want to very briefly address a question that came in, which was related to shared locker rooms and shower spaces. And this may also come up in the context of schools, universities, or any employer who offers shower facilities for their employees. The same rule applies with respect to restrooms, locker rooms, and shower facilities. You need to allow access to the individual based on the alignment with their gender identity. And so that is the rule, whether it's a bathroom or a locker room or a shower space. And again, you can create single-use alternatives that may end up working for everyone involved, but you cannot force that option.
All right, Paul. I think that leads us to the pretty obvious follow-up question, and this, in fact, is the follow-up question that we hear almost every time we give the advice that you just gave, which is, okay, but what about all of my other employees who complain or who are afraid? And we see that's in the news right now. I think it's there's a petition in Idaho that men have started to protect the women in their lives who they feel are unfairly exposed to transgender employees or transgender individuals in the women's restroom. It makes them very uncomfortable. What do you do about that?
That's a really important question, Sarah. And as I've gone around to different employers facilitating trainings or facilitating workshops, this is something we hear a lot. And it's important to listen to the fears, listen to the complaints of other employees, because they often are genuine. And so I think the best way to deal with complaints and fears is make sure that there is someone in HR who is identifiable, that employees who are uncomfortable, they can go to that person in HR and they can express that fear. And I think that's really important for these employees to have an outlet. It also can be helpful to have a facilitated workshop or have some kind of diversity training that involves an opportunity for employees to express these fears, either privately or in a group setting where they can talk about it. Now, with that said, these fears are not a reasonable or an adequate basis for taking discriminatory action against a transgender employee. So it's important to make sure that the employees are not expressing these fears to the transgender employee directly, because that could create a burden or provide grounds for a hostile work environment claim. So that's why having someone in HR who can handle these complaints or having opportunities for these to be expressed is important.
And I can't underline that enough. I feel like in so many situations, not just dealing with gender identity, but having a strong HR staff and having an HR staff that can help the employees with these concerns and feels empowered to do that is critical in addressing these types of concerns. When I deal with employers who express or who are concerned about fear that their employees may have in sharing a bathroom with someone who is a transgender individual, I often hearken back, and Paul is going to stop me if he doesn't like this analogy, but I often go back to, well, what would you say if you had an employee who said, you know, I'm not comfortable sitting next to a Muslim? I feel very unsafe given the world today. It makes me feel uncomfortable and not secure in the workplace. I don't want to have to sit next to a Muslim. I think most, if not all, I hope all HR professionals would not honor, they would talk to that employee, but they would not honor that request, and they would not segregate a Muslim employee based on their religion because of what, frankly, are irrational fears.
I think that's exactly right, Sarah. I am noticing a lot of questions coming in from the audience on this topic, and I just want to respond with two additional things. In addition to the analogy that Sarah shared, I think you could have an open discussion with an employee expressing fears and make two comments that may help. One is that for all transgender people, they are going to be the most prudish private person in a restroom facility that you have ever met. There will be no flashing of genitals. There will be no indecent exposure. There will be no peeping toms. We're talking about folks who are really awkward often about their bodies, particularly while they're going under transition. So I think that's one thing that can be mentioned. Another thing is that transgender people have been using sex-segregated facilities for years already, either at your own workplace or in other places. And employers and institutions who have adopted the policies that we're telling you need to be adopted now and that the EEOC has been telling employers need to be adopted now, these have been in place in many states, localities, and institutions for years, and there has been no increase in privacy complaints. There has been no increase in any kind of assault or harassment. So I think that an evidence-based approach may somewhat meet the concerns that an employee has.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. That is very practical. Let's move on to the next very common set of questions that we face. That's pronouns and name changes. And this deals with essentially vernacular verbiage. How do you speak and how do you speak about your transgender employees? And before we get into the questions, let me just highlight the fact that I think that one of the reasons this comes up so frequently is because it is difficult and it is not as ingrained naturally in our way of speaking. And so your employees are making a conscious effort and do need to make a conscious effort to change the way they speak about transgender employees. To highlight just how difficult it can be to keep this verbiage straight, let's look at our own survey. We said transgendered. We meant transgender. That's a mistake that happens frequently. It's something that you just need to be aware of so you can deal with it and address it. The correct word in this survey, as several of you have pointed out, is transgender, but we make mistakes just like all of our clients. So, Paul, back to pronouns. Which pronoun should I use with a transgender employee?
For a transgender employee, you should use the pronoun that they prefer. And if you're not sure what that is, you should ask them what they feel most comfortable with. And based on that conversation, that's the pronoun that you should use, and that if they want their coworkers, their colleagues, their supervisors to use, you should enforce the use of that pronoun by any other employees who are likely to work with them.
When do you make that change?
So if you're in the situation where you're hiring someone and you find out they're transgender, but they've already gone through the gender transition, so when they meet employees at their new workplace, they're only going to be known by the current name and pronoun. So you should just continue along with that name and pronoun, and you should maintain the privacy of that individual by not revealing their prior name or their prior pronoun to anyone. So if they are transitioning at work, then a best practice is for HR to sit down and have a conversation and outline a timeline of when the employee wants to transition, when they want to start using the new pronouns and new name changes, and you should work together to create a date. And from that date going forward, the pronoun should be changed and the change should be enforced.
And Paul, what I'm hearing you say in your answers is that this is really employee guided. This is a question that needs to be answered by the transgender employee, and that it is that employee's choice which pronoun to use, when to make the change, et cetera.
That's right, Sarah. And I should also point out, given some of the questions we're getting, that you need to make the name and pronoun change even if the employee has not changed all of their legal documents. Now, I'm going to put a little asterisk here, and this is where you would need to get some more detailed advice. If you are in a healthcare profession or in a government contracting situation, there are going to be several asterisks here. I'm not going to go through the whole line of them, but there may be situations where before you can change names of individuals, you need to get paperwork changed. But if you're not in one of those situations, then you really need to change the name and pronoun at the employee's request, even if they haven't gone through all their document changes. One particular reason for this is that there are some states still in the South who, if a transgender employee was born in Tennessee, for example, they are legally prohibited from ever changing their birth certificate. So there may be some obstacles for folks not being able to change their documents. But this is a murky area where you should get some advice.
Oh, I completely agree with that. Who should be told about the name changes and the pronoun changes?
So you should really defer again to the employee about who should be told, but generally other employees who are going to be interacting with this individual in their department, supervisors should be informed. Those are the general audiences. Now, if an employee is located in one building and is only going to interact with other employees in that building, you don't need to do a memo to the entire company about the name change. But really, it should be limited to the smallest audience that is necessary to make sure that other coworkers and supervisors are using the correct name.
Okay. Now, finally, what about new hires who are previously transitioned? So, in other words, when you hire someone who has already transitioned.
Right. So I think I skipped a little bit ahead on that slide and answered that, and that you need to keep the previous name and previous pronoun private.
Sorry, Paul. I was reading through the questions that were coming in. We're getting a lot on pronoun use. But I realized that, we only have 15 minutes left. So we'll skip to privacy and communications, and hopefully we'll get back to some of those questions about W-2s and I-9s. I think this is, Paul, this also goes to everything you just said, and it has to do with the employee really guiding the process. But the overarching question is, how do you help an employee who's transitioning?
So there are many ways to help an employee who is transitioning at work. Like I mentioned, the first and foremost important thing that should always happen is there should be an open and friendly and very supportive conversation between the employee and HR. And you should probably have several of these conversations once you either hear about an employee from from coworkers, you hear an employee wants to transition or is experiencing some harassment or some difficulties, you'll want to intervene, or when the employee approaches you. So having those initial conversations and doing a lot of listening, asking questions about, how far along are you in the process? When would you like to make a social transition at work? Are there any people who are giving you problems that we need to have a conversation with? Kind of identifying some areas that might be of concern and getting together a timeline. Now, there are some questions here since we're short on time and we want to make sure we get to more of your individual questions. I'll just kind of group these together on this slide. But a gender transition memorandum is something that you should talk about with your employee. And what that basically says is it's an email correspondence that can go out to their coworkers and supervisors that says, employee X is going to be going through a gender transition at work. Here's a little bit about why, if the employee wants to do that. And here's a little bit about the timeline. Here's the new name that the employee is going by. Here's the pronouns. Should alert that the employee will be using the new restroom. And should also identify the person in HR who employees can go to if they have concerns or fears or any questions. And that memorandum makes sure that everyone in the workplace is on the same page to avoid the kind of situations that we saw in these EEOC complaints that I told you about earlier, where people were not allowed to use the correct restroom or were getting misgendered or having their name not used correctly. We want to avoid those kinds of situations, so having a gender transition memorandum is helpful. You could also have a facilitated meeting that may or may not involve the employee, and that I've seen work wonders with employers, where everybody kind of comes away feeling really good about knowing what their obligations are and also knowing, you know, best practices to how to support this employee, because a lot of people want to be a good person and to be a good coworker and figure out how to do that. So you can do that as well as having trainings to prevent discomfort and potential harassment, those kinds of things. And I think documentation is something important. I'll let Sarah maybe mention that, but it's important to make sure that you have the employee document that their agreement with all of these kinds of things.
Absolutely. You want to document their agreement. You want to document their buy-in. And even before you start documentation, I think that Paul mentioned this, but I really want to underline for all of you that to the extent you have a gender transition memorandum, that happens only with affected employee buy-in. In other words, if the transgender individual does not want there to be a memorandum, which would be understandable, if they don't want that, then you don't do it. If they don't want a facilitated meeting, then, well, that's a little more of a gray area. If you find this is an issue at the workplace, you may need to have an anti-harassment training. But to start off, if you have someone who is transitioning, a facilitated meeting is a great resource if the employee wants it. Now, Paul, despite modestly not mentioning this, has actually guided these meetings for a number of our employees with tremendous success, both including the transgender individual and then also excluding. So people, I mean, as we're seeing in our questions from you all, there are a lot of concerns, a lot of legitimate concerns, by legitimate, I mean sincere, truly held concerns that people have that they want to be able to express, and that sometimes having the transgender employee step out of the room during the training can be helpful. Paul has found that anyway. All of this, I mean, the main takeaway from privacy and communication to coworkers and others is that, again, this is guided by the transgender individual. And you want to make sure that then once you have their buy-in, you document. Much like any HR concern or any sensitive issue, you need to have some paperwork that shows what you've done to deal with the situation, any concerns the transgender employee has raised, how you've dealt with them, and ask them if there's anything else that you would like them to do. Paul?
One other thing that can lower the risk that some people are expressing may result from this kind of meeting is you can have a meeting with the other coworkers where the transgender employee is not there, or maybe they're not there for part of it, so that people can express themselves in a more closed environment, and this has been one way to do that. Now, I just briefly want to address a few other questions that have been popping in. Somebody mentioned, well, what about the law in North Carolina, and what if other states adopt a law like they have in North Carolina? And just briefly, that law is a state law that says for public restrooms, a transgender person can only use the restroom that corresponds with their biological sex or their birth certificate. So, and that a local jurisdiction cannot enact a rule that says a transgender person can access the bathroom that corresponds with their gender identity. So North Carolina has this law. There are other state legislatures. I think there are 10 state legislatures that are considering this law. So what do you do in those states? Well, this law in particular is limited to public restrooms. So if you are a public employer in North Carolina, this is going to be a difficult situation for you. You likely will have to comply with North Carolina law, but again, this is kind of a murky situation. However, if you are a private employer, you are still required to follow the rules of the EEOC, and the law in North Carolina doesn't change that, and you still need to give access to your transgender employees to the bathroom that corresponds with their gender identity. Now, there's a federal lawsuit already involved on this issue. It will likely be resolved in the next few years, but that's our general advice. However, if you have employees operating in one of these states, again, it's best to seek legal counsel to get through the thicket of local, state, and federal laws on those issues.
That's exactly right, Paul. And I do think that, you know, until we have clear federal guidance, assume that federal law trumps, assume that gender identity is protected just like sex, national origin, religion, et cetera. And then if you are in one of those limited jurisdictions where there's conflicting state law, call a lawyer. Don't try to navigate this on your own. Paul, I also want to point out on our topic of trainings, because we had someone on who's participating in the webinar make an excellent suggestion, which is offer a training, offer an opportunity to have a facilitated conversation before you are dealing with a transitioning employee. As we learned, most of you on this call have a transgender employee or someone who is transgender who has transitioned at the workplace, which means for those of you who haven't, it's likely coming. Have the conversation now before there is someone who you have to think about how to dance around the subject with them, and just have that conversation with your entire workforce so that everybody's ready for it when it comes. All right, Paul, sorry to cut you off.
Oh, no, that's fine, Sarah. We just had two other questions, and this kind of relates to our incorrect use of the word transgendered. That's not a word you should use. It should be transgender. Somebody also asked, what about transsexual? Well, the technical medical definition for transsexual is someone who has had sexual reassignment surgery. So that would be a subset of the population of transgender individuals. Now, transsexual is kind of fallen out of fashion. I wouldn't say that it is to the level of a slur, but I would avoid the use because it is limited only to folks who have undergone sexual reassignment surgery. And something a lot of people don't know, but the vast majority of transgender people, even transgender people who have transitioned for decades, do not undergo sexual reassignment surgery and never will, for a number of medical and personal reasons. And so, again, I need to emphasize that having sexual assignment surgery is not a requirement for access to a bathroom, is not a requirement to receive protected status under state and federal law. And then someone asked for a definition of sexual orientation, and I just briefly want to address that because sexual orientation would mean someone who is gay, lesbian, or bisexual, and it's important to note that a person's gender identity is different than their sexual orientation. So someone who is transgender could be straight. In fact, most transgender people are straight and transgender. You could also have a transgender person who is gay, lesbian, or bisexual. So hopefully that clarifies that.
Paul, can I address one other question that just came in?
Go ahead, and I have another one after you.
Okay, great. And this, I think, is an excellent question, and it is a confusing area. It has to do with the intersection of laws, federal laws, state laws, local regulations. The question was essentially, we say federal law trumps, but now we have these state-specific regulations that seem to contradict federal law. How do we know which applies? Do the restrictive state laws trump federal law? Does federal law trump state law? The answer is, that is a very confusing choice of laws question that really we don't think you should delve into. Ultimately, federal law, and this is true in every area of the law, federal law supersedes state law. However, for that to be true, there has to be clear federal law on the exact point. So sometimes states will argue there are very narrow carve-outs for certain issues that they can, where they can enact more restrictive laws. I could go on about this actually for far too long, so I will stop talking there. But to answer the question of what do we look to, federal or state law, this is why we do think that when you're dealing with an area where you feel, if you feel like there's any uncertainty over which law should apply, you really should contact a lawyer and let the lawyer walk you through what the best practice is. Don't try to resolve conflicting federal and state and local laws on your own. You'll get yourself into a mess.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Sarah. And I would say, yes, federal law sets the standard. However, it's important to look at the state and local, because if they require more regulation, then you need to follow that increased regulation for sure. But where there are subtle differences or things that may be in contrast, then it's important to get some help working through that. Let's see, we also had a question about gender-neutral pronouns. And you may have, there was a New York Times article this morning, I believe, The Rise of They, T-H-E-Y, as a Pronoun. And there are folks who do not identify as male or female. Again, this is getting back to the gender binary where we've basically constructed there's only two options, male and female. Well, a lot of people are rejecting that gender binary, and they are choosing to identify as somewhere in between or something different. And so you're seeing gender-neutral pronouns such as they or them. You'll also hear others, but those are the most common, they and them, when referring to a person. So the question becomes, do you need to use these gender-neutral pronouns? And I'll say I've already seen two cases, one in Oregon and one elsewhere, where there was an individual who requested to be known as they and them. It was a camp counselor kind of setting. And the employer was really uncomfortable with having that conversation, not only with coworkers, but trying to explain this concept to children. So I think that the answer here is that I have never seen an agency ruling on this from the EEOC, at least not in Oregon. I've not heard of an agency ruling in any other state. So I think this is kind of the next wave. If you think transgender is new in the next wave, well, the real next wave is gender expression and gender-neutral pronouns, gender-neutral identification. Folks who may look masculine or feminine or somewhere in between and want to be identified as they, them. A best practice would be, again, having these sensitive conversations with your employee where you can accommodate them on their use, but where you are really uncomfortable, then contact your lawyer, because it would be important to see what the state and local regulations on this. I don't think there's any federal regulation, at least yet, that says you have to allow the use of these pronouns, but I think that's the direction that we're eventually going to be heading.
All right, thank you, Paul. I think we are just about out of time. Paul, did you have?
Well, there's a comment that we wanted to close with. Did you?
Well, yes. First,
okay.
First, let me just point everyone. I just flashed you over to the slide guidance. Now, in general, we do think that when you're dealing with very specific topics or very specific questions, it's probably best at this stage with the uncertain law to loop in an attorney. However, for general guidance, the EEOC has not yet published regulations regarding gender identity discrimination, unfortunately. However, the Office of Personnel Management is essentially HR for the government, for the federal government.
Oh, sorry about that. Can everybody hear me now? Okay. While the EEOC has not published its regulations regarding gender identity, the Office of Personnel Management, which is the government's HR department, does have regulations for federal agencies and federal employers regarding how to deal and how to address certain issues that come up with transgender employees. We have a link to that website here. While, again, when you're dealing with very specific questions, we do recommend, not just because we're lawyers, but we do recommend that you contact a lawyer because these are very sticky issues. This will provide you some good basic question and answer format style for how to deal with certain issues that come up with transgender employees. Now, just in closing, we had a comment from a listener that I think is really, and we all think really sums up what we're saying, and I'm going to read it in part here, which is, perhaps the key thing to remember is that while people are trying to sort out their feelings and positions, the transgendered person is quite simply just that, a person like you and me doing their best to live well and lovingly in a difficult situation. I think that really just hits the nail on the head, and that is good advice in just about every area of employment law, is that your employees are just people, and most of the time they're just doing their best. Treat them like people and treat them like individuals, and you'll probably be able to navigate this. Paul, any last words?
No, I think that about sums it up. And if you'd like to contact either Sarah or I, our contact information is there, and we'd be happy to follow up with you on any questions we couldn't get to today. Thank you very much, and thank you to Jenna for being our moderator here.
All right. Thanks.